Alright, so we're here today for the release of the 23rd issue of Left Turn Magazine. And the usually there's sort of a theme to each issue where they try to go in depth into a specific topic. The cover of this issue is Mexico on the Brink. And in spite of the fact that there's been like a Mexico event every night in New York City for like the last 2 weeks, I think it's actually a really good turnout, given that. And that has a lot to do with what's going on, of course. My name's RJ, been sort of connected to Left Turn for a while now. Was in Mexico at the beginning of the year reporting for Narco News, mainly from Oaxaca. And since coming back, I've sort of written about the solidarity work that's going on here, along with the other campaign, which is also going on here in New York City, the other campaign of the Zapatistas, which Connect's gonna get into later. Also been trying to write about how it connects to stuff that we are doing here. And for more information, go to zappagringo.com. our topic tonight is Mexico, and just to kind of present that, I think, you know, last forum was about Lebanon, and I think something that's particularly important about Mexico isn't just its proximity to the United States. It isn't just that we're neighbors, but I think actually that an argument could be made that we're kind of the same country. And, you know, in spite of the fact that they're building a massive wall between these two states, an argument could be made that we're actually two countries. So there's a lot of interesting parallels to Palestine, actually. And those are parallels that have not been lost on Mexican or Palestinian organizers. There's been both very interesting messages from Mexican activists throughout the last year in solidarity with Palestinians, and vice versa. Most recently, and this kind of connects to the wall, Jamal Juma, who coordinates the anti-apartheid wall campaign, wrote a beautiful letter to Oaxaca on behalf of the campaign. So there's a lot of interesting connections. These are the sorts of connections that we draw on Left Turn, and it's not sort of some fantasy. These are connections that are really being drawn by people in those countries as well. Also of importance is the fact that half of Spanish-speaking people in the United States are Mexican. Those are the U.S. residents, right? And then you add another 12 million people who are living without citizenship, and Mexico is alive and well, 25 million strong, on this side of the Rio Grande. So it's another kind of aspect to it. There's also a sort of importance in terms of Mexico's position within Latin America as the second largest economy. It used to be the first. Brazil just overtook it last year. Second largest economy in Latin America, and it's also the 11th most populous nation on Earth. So we're talking about a sort of a really a massive country, too. And the changes that take place there have ripple effects not just throughout the United States, but throughout Latin America and around the world. And again, these are effects that are not lost on the organizers that are organizing within Mexico. Both the APO movement and Oaxaca, which Calamity is going to touch on in their slideshow, where there have been APO solidarity actions throughout the world. There's been popular assemblies of the people of fill in the blank, APOs, formed throughout the United States and other parts of the world, as well as the other campaign initiated by the Zapatistas, and also the proposal for a global network. So these are movements that are also intentionally and consciously connecting with movements around the world. And even within Latin America, there's a big discourse going on about how to make change, and the sort of back and forth of from below or from above. And one of the proposals is that perhaps Mexico will become a reference point of revolutions from below. That's been a proposal of the other campaign that Connect's gonna get into. Also, there's a little piece about Texas, California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico and Utah, which all used to be Mexico. So, Yeah. Without further ado, I'm going to present our first speaker. Let me get the vibe here, Renee. Renee Rojas is a first-year sociology student at NYU, focusing on neoliberal regimes in Latin America and challenges from below from a political, economy, and class analysis perspective. Prior to returning to New York City, he spent years accompanying and documenting grassroots struggles in Mexico, including the fight against plans to build a new international airport in Texcoco and the Plan Puebla Panama. Renee is going to be giving us a bit of background going over the last century or so in about 15 minutes.
Thanks a lot. I'm going to try to do this. There's a lot to cover in a little time. And more than that, there's a lot of really complex things to cover in a short period of time. I think Mexico, you know, RJ mentioned some of the things that make Mexico stand out in Latin America and make it a logical reference point. So, you know, for this new wave, this new left movement that is being built every day and that is rising in Latin America, it's imperative, I think, that we really understand what's going on in Mexico. There are huge differences between what's happening in Mexico today and, let's say, Bolivia or Venezuela, but there are some similarities as well. Regardless of what the parallels or lack of parallels might be, you know, we need to understand how Mexico fits into this larger panorama and also how it's going to have an impact on it. You know, people have tried to understand Mexican politics, modern Mexican politics, from many different perspectives. I think they're all valid. We need to play them off of each other. Examine them critically. It's important. I'm going to try to do that, but it's also going to be somewhat of a survey, so bear with me. Lastly, before I just get into the more substantive stuff, I want to say that the real central question, I think, for the revolution in Latin America that Mexico poses is what RG already mentioned, this notion of revolution from below, as opposed to the classical models of revolution from above by the enlightened vanguard organization leading the way. A sub-question to that is the relationship of popular movements and revolutionary movements to the state. I don't think it's the same question, and we need to be very clear on that distinction. To give an example, I mean, Venezuela has a huge movement from below, yet it engages state politics on a daily level. You know, and I think that's what the phenomenon of Chavez kind of represents. So there's a lot to think about. I hope that some of the things that I'll talk about will get us thinking along these lines. I'm going to miss things. Again, just bear with me. I want to start off by saying that I think the last 100 years of Mexican politics have largely been characterized by a very intense struggle between the ruling elite, ruling oligarchy, however you want to call it, and popular classes, sectors, communities, national communities, including indigenous communities. You know, people running the show in Mexico have been trying to gain the consent or control over these people, you know, the majority of the people in Mexico, through one way or another. And it's often erupted in very intense struggles. Often it kind of calms down. We're in a phase now of upheaval. It's really nothing new in Mexico. I think, largely speaking, they've tried to do it in two different ways. The first has been something that pretty much anyone who knows about Mexico knows about, is this corporatist developmentalist model run by the PRI, where the idea was to incorporate the peasants, the indigenous people, the workers, whatever, and gain their control in some sort of class or social pact, right? Where obviously the elite remained the primary and controlling group. That lasted 70 years, and that system pretty much exhausted itself in, let's probably starting in a very intense way, a very acute way, in 88. By 2000, a couple of presidential administrations later, it had to be done away with altogether. I mean, the Mexican elite could no longer maintain this kind of consent/control through these means, so they came up with what has been tried in Latin America, you know, after the dictatorships in many countries, which is the bourgeois liberal model. Here's what's fascinating about Mexico, and it's great for anyone who wants to see change, you know, deep transformation happen from below. That model essentially exhausted itself in 6 years.
Hmm.
In 6 years, it proved unviable. This presents a huge challenge, obviously, to the right and to the leading economic groups and to the U.S., you know, by association. But I think it likely poses a huge challenge to the people making the revolution from below, the different actors. The movements in Mexico now have to understand what that means and have to come up with a strategy to take advantage of that weakness that the elite now is suffering in its attempt to keep on controlling things and really move the movement qualitatively forward. It's my opinion. But anyway, let me just start. I mean, everyone knows that the revolution happened early part of the century. 1917 was probably the culminating year of the revolution. Essentially, what happened was that a liberal, if we have neoliberal now, a very liberal regime back then, the Porfirio Díaz or Porfiriato regime, had this idea of modernizing the economy. It opened up the economy in such a way that it only promoted, you know, extraction of minerals, exports of raw materials, and one fraction, I guess, of the ruling class really won out. There was huge growth. Everyone thought, you know, this was the answer to Mexican development until obviously it bottomed out very quickly. At which point, the ruling, another part of the ruling class, which wanted to modernize Mexican society the way European societies were doing, said, oh, you know what, this doesn't work. We got to get rid of this old dictator. We have to start our own industries, our national manufacturing, et cetera, modernize agriculture, et cetera. So that was one ingredient. Another big ingredient, which really, as these things usually occur, provided the energy, the fuel, so to speak, the people, you know, for the revolution, were the indigenous and peasant communities that had seen their resources, their land, encroached upon in such a way that essentially they were facing how can I say it? Well, they had nothing else to lose, right? And then that got organized in two very specific ways through, you know, armed movements, the Eastas and the North, Saladistas, and the central and southern part of Mexico. All these things came together, and it's important to realize these things did come together. I mean, Zapata and Villa would go and meet with Madero, you know, who's having he was a guy who was defending his vote, right? There was fraud back then as well. But they found out a way together to really make the country, they found a way to come together in a way that really made the country explode. After that upheaval, obviously, you know, we know Villa and Zapata were betrayed, symbolized in their assassinations in the later part of the decade, 1919 for Zapata, 2021 for Villa. Anyway, what happened then is that a new ruling elite established itself, but not without tension. After the revolution, they understood that you couldn't go on doing things the old way. You know, it was important to gain consent from below. After all, I mean, the indigenous communities, which just 10 years ago that no one had even thought about, really, essentially checkmated the system. So this is why I think the PRI had to come up with a different model. It reached its most popular expression under Lázaro Cárdenas, who became president in the mid-30s. He did some pretty extraordinary things considering what he was up against. Nationalized the oil industry after a strike by oil workers. And essentially, after that point, had to give the industry over to the workers. There was direct worker control because all the managers, you know, actually had left. He expropriated land, 50 million acres. I mean, it was a big deal. And lastly, he nationalized other big industries, the commanding heights of the economy, so to speak. That model started to break down as well. I mean, the 40s and the 50s were a period of this national development model, which, you know, import substitution, or, you know, the people really thought that the national bourgeoisie could form an alliance with the popular classes, etc. By the 60s, it became obvious that you know, it wasn't the case. There were built-in contradictions in that alliance. And while the PRI model was pretty good at keeping things under control, there were already huge peasant revolts in the 60s. One precursor to what came later was in 1962, this guy in Morelos, Zapata's territory, Rubén Jaramillo, started a peasant movement, was, you know, brutally repressed. That kind of became the trend. We all know that in the 60s, in the second half of the 60s, there was a, you know, very active guerrilla movement in Guerrero. The students were becoming politicized, radicalized, leading to the massacre in 1968. Essentially, by 1970, when Echeverria was president, everyone knew that something had to change on both sides. The popular sector started thinking more strategically, thinking about attacking and taking state power. So you had the remnants of the student movement actually form guerrilla, guerrilla bands, right? And they tried to link up with what was happening in Guerrero. They didn't have much success, but by the 80s, I'm rushing through this now, you gotta excuse me. By the 80s, the economics of this had ceased to become viable as well. So you had the neoliberal model in full effect after the crises of the early 80s. By 87, 88, the model was in such a deep crisis that it effectively split, and that's where you had the birth of the PRD. Didn't officially become PRD until 87, but in the 88 elections, they mounted a challenge to the PRI. Everyone knows the story of the elections in 88 when they were, you know, there's just massive fraud. Salinas de Gortari becomes president. The PRD becomes the opposition party, but kind of loses all its radical elements very quickly, becomes a party of the system. Until we get to essentially the 90s, leading up to Fox's election. I already talked a bit about what it meant to do away with the PRI and try a new model of control under Fox, which is quickly disintegrated. Lastly, there was one important thing that occurred in the 80s, in 1985, which was the earthquake. The earthquake in 85 really kind of exposed, right, the structural problems which were happening, the corruption as well, deep corruption, and it kind of reactivated what you know people commonly term as civil society. At that point, there was also a strategic decision made by some of the former more radical Marxist-Leninist groupings, for instance, the precursors of the Zapatistas, to go into the urban neighborhoods as well and start doing work there. So by the time you know the model exhausts itself completely, you have all these players in place. I think what we're seeing today is the logical next step. You know, as the PRI 70-year model proved inefficient, as Fox's little 6-year attempt to control things withered away, what do you have? Well, you have now people saying we're searching for alternatives. None of this works. And you also have, on the part of the ruling elite, desperation, I would say. There's such a crisis of legitimacy right now that the only thing they know how to do, and we're gonna see much more of it, I predict, is direct repression and persecution of the popular movement. I'll leave it at that. I mean, I did wanna start talking about the three main, I think, actors out there right now from the popular perspective or from the, what you might call, left, but I think we can get into that in the discussion at the end. I'll leave it at that for now. There's a lot to talk about. It's a very complex and at the same time very exciting situation. But we really have to get a firm grasp. We really have to do a sharp reading of what's going on. Because of what I said, because there's such a breakdown in this, there's such a crisis of legitimacy of the regime right now that, you know, their backs are up against the wall. And if that's the case, you know, they will unleash as they have, and they'll continue to unleash repression. I'll just say one more thing about that. People think the BRI is old history in Mexico. That's not actually the case. The BRIista model of control is history. But the BRI remains a central element in any new strategy that the ruling elite has to maintain control. One quick obvious example of that. For the plan to be able to somehow make Calderon president after all the popular protests following the electoral fraud, they need an alliance with the PRI, right? If the PRI didn't back the PAN on that, then there was no way that he would have been inaugurated at all, and this crisis of legitimacy that I'm talking about would have become even deeper. What does that mean? That means that the PAN owes a lot back to the PRI. And that's why the PAN, I don't think right now the PAN really wants what's happening in Oaxaca, but it can't do anything else. It has to allow the BRI to maintain these little feuds it has throughout the feuds in the sense of feudal. They control these territories and these bureaucracies and these resources. That's a really evil combination on the part of the ruling. So I do want to point that out. There's a lot, you know, that can happen, and things will move forward. It's got to be well thought out. And we have to know what we're up against.
Cool, thanks for that. All right, next up is Veruca Calamity Peller. I hope I'm pronouncing
it. It's okay.
No, you're next. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I've participated in anti-authoritarian collectives in Mexico for the past 4 years, and just returned from Oaxaca, Mexico. She will give a slideshow presentation on the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, the life of the barricades, international solidarity, and the brutal repression and assassinations at the hands of paramilitaries and police.
Well, things are kind of different now that I have 20 minutes. Wait, just wait on a photo for a second. Because I have 20 minutes, I'm just going to assume that you guys know more or less what led up to the resistance in Oaxaca. And I'm not going to give a whole bunch of background. I'm just going to hop right into it. But I just want to say that, for one thing, this overwhelming feeling I got in Oaxaca that I compare to here is that, you know, in Oaxaca, the revolution or resistance, it's not this big puzzle. It's not, of course, it's something that's debated and discussed and that people are meeting about and stuff like this. But in Oaxaca, people weren't doing anything by the book. They weren't so-and-so said this, and in this volume, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't really done like that. It was kind of done on the fly, and people were experimenting a lot, and just making their own decisions based on their own type of experiences down there. And so what I went into really was this space that was just this open space for rebellion, pretty much. This ungovernability that the federal government was calling Oaxaca really was this opportunity for people to start controlling their lives, to not be repressed anymore. They weren't governed, and so therefore they weren't repressed. How did this happen? Because they stopped recognizing authority, they stopped recognizing the political class, they stopped recognizing the governor. And so although the governor didn't leave, because he was chilling out in, you know, some type of barricaded up house outside of Oaxaca City. Even though he didn't leave, the people made him leave in practice through all these different acts of civil disobedience, creating barricades, marching in the streets, and setting forth a new political mandate, which is the APO, which is the Popular Assembly of Oaxaca. And so they took political control over the city without actually taking power. just simply by not recognizing the government. And also tactically, it was brilliant because it created this kind of, I don't want to say fearless state, but the state in which you know, like anything was possible. And then no matter what kind of repression kind of comes down on us, pretty much was what they were saying is that, you know, we still don't recognize authority. Whereas here, you know, okay, I'm gonna get into that later. Anyway, I'm gonna go through the slideshow and try to like kind of keep track and talk about what's going on in these photos. So when I was in Oaxaca, I was in after the entrance of the PFP. And so I was basically in a city that was occupied by the PFP. The PFP were the Preventive Federal Police were occupying the Zocalo. And, you know, all this other type of repression was coming out of that. And, you know, like what you were talking about was what had to be done. The reason that the PAN sent in the PFP was because they needed PRI support to be able to have like a smooth landing for Calderon, who was coming in under all this illegitimacy. And so the PRI said, we'll do that, you know, we'll have the support, but you guys got to keep Ulises in. And so this type of space that you're walking into, like I said, is a space completely controlled by the people. So even though that the PFP were in the city, you know, the people were like, we still occupy our city in practice. And so these are the last barricade. When I was there, the last remaining barricade after the PFP had come in was the barricade surrounding the university radio. And this is the barricade right there. This is where I lived for most of the month that I was in Oaxaca. On November 2nd, when the PFP, the federal police, tried to come in and evict the barricade with water tanks and helicopters shooting tear gas, and thousands of heavily armed federal forces, merely like, you know, a few hundred barricade defenders, people from this neighborhood and people defending the last APO-controlled university radio, or radio period, after all the media, the radio and the television takeovers, but a few hundred of them managed to force the PFP to retreat. And so it was this amazing victory. This barricade is actually not really here anymore because towards the end of November, after all the repression that came out of November 25th, there was really little support for physical support for the radio just because people were getting thrown in jail and really couldn't be on the streets because they were getting disappeared by paramilitaries or thrown in jail by the police forces. And so eventually, under all the threats and the pressure, the radio had to be given back to the university authorities. And something about the repression that was coming towards this barricade is really symbolic of what I think is one of the most important tactics, and I think it's an unconscious tactic in Oaxaca, was this idea of a movement without pause. So even though we were waking up to bullets literally, you know, flying feet over us while we were in our sleeping bags, and even though people would leave the barricade and not come back, either because they were being disappeared or because they were being arrested, even the women were being raped by the federal forces, even though everybody, you know, almost everybody who was active in the struggle was getting threatened, people were on the run, they weren't staying at their normal houses, they were staying in other places, they were hiding out. Even though all of this was going on, people kept on acting. They were always in the streets. They were always defending their spaces. They were always organizing. They were always marching. They just did not stop. There was no pause. You know, in the United States, there was all this anti-globalization momentum and all this momentum, and then there was 9/11, and everybody, you know, just kind of like paused in the awe of the repression that came after 9/11. And so because they're not, you know, the people of Oaxaca don't really recognize authority, they have nothing to pause in awe of. You know, repression is something that was definitely, you know, very hard to deal with, and it was slowing people down, and it was very scary, and it caused a lot of pain and stuff like this. But the Oaxacans and the other people around Mexico who were inside just kept on going all the time. These are all shots from that barricade that I'm telling you about right now. There was, like I said, there was something called caravans of death, which were kind of like, you know, these trucks of paramilitaries, you know, who are state-funded assassins or local police in civilian clothing that would go around like pretty much every other day and shoot at the barricades. Sometimes in the morning, one time they gravely injured a young student at the barricade who was hit in the hip. And this is the type of repression that people are dealing with, and they stayed there. And they sat there and they defended their barricade with sticks and stones and Molotovs and these bazookas that you see, which is like PVC piping with fireworks. They're not really bazookas, but that's what they call them there. Like one of these. And so people, pretty much just kept on going. Another thing I want to say about the type of tactics that you see in Oaxaca was that people are constantly flipping the script on the government. They were constantly using the government using repression in a way that kind of like revealed what the repression was. I don't know really how to explain it. When the PFP came in, for instance, they came in a very brutal fashion. They started, going through offices, beating people, coming in with water tanks, again, tear gas, launching helicopters and stuff like this. A lot of people got injured, people got killed, and people met the PFP with flowers. And people just put their bodies in front of the tanks. That doesn't mean they were resisting peacefully or pacifistly, but they were saying, like, okay, you're going to come with repression, we're going to show you what you are. And in a little while more, I'll show you some actions that women did that did the same thing. As well, when the government would try to, when the federal government was attempting to negotiate with the APO in ways that, with some of the, can you kind of pause for a second? With the negotiations that just weren't really going to work out, the APO kind of derailed the negotiations. There was another time, that the government wanted to talk to the APO in Mexico City, some closed, private, shady negotiations. And the APO was like, all right, that's what you want to do. We're going to just like open up a format with the civil society, an open format with the civil society of Oaxaca, to show you what you're doing is all behind closed doors and what we're doing is open. And it really was a popular movement. These kids lived at the barricade. They were street children. And Flavio Sosa, who's really interesting on the side of the PRD's role in the APO, he's one of the spokespeople of the APO who some people like and some people really hate. And he's been involved with the PRD party since its birth in the 80s. And he also had some support and backing for Fox and the PAN during those elections in 2000, just because I think he wanted the PRI, who was in for 71 years, to get out. As Flavio Sosa said that they were gonna, that he personally was gonna create a space for the barricade children, or for these homeless children who didn't have families who were living with the barricades, which he never did. These kids, I don't know where they are right now. And a lot of people in these photos could be, disappeared, or one of the 250 people who are in jail getting tortured right now, so that's something to keep in mind too. Okay, can you keep on going? Another thing, this is nighttime at the barricade, about a 14-year-old boy. Another thing about the barricades was the barricades were super controversial at the time that I was in Oaxaca. Again, you're talking about within this is Santo Domingo Plaza, by the way, the second APO encampment after they were forced out of the Zocalo when the PFP came in. So anyway, back to the barricades. The barricades, before the PFP came in and evicted a lot of the neighborhood barricades, the barricades were the space that was kind of like, this is like rebellious organizing space that wasn't like in some type of like format. These are people who have disappeared, and signs for them, for some of the arrested and disappeared that are in the that are in Santo Domingo Plaza. Anyway, so all the neighborhoods were organized into barricades, and they were organized on a neighborhood basis. And this was like really kind of like a protective element, because of the type of repression with the PRI supporters and the paramilitaries that were coming around and attacking people in the neighborhoods who were supporters of the APO. And also, can you slow down? Can you pause? I'm losing track of what I'm saying. And also, a format in which people are organizing within themselves. And so the APO was kind of like this umbrella in which all these other neighborhoods would organize. And so that, for some of the the elements in the APO, which are very few, but there were some elements in the APO that were trying to kind of exercise power or control over, other people in the resistance in Oaxaca. This is what's brilliant about popular assemblies and about a popular resistance, is that you can't really exercise, there's nobody who in the end can exercise power. Flavio Sosa and some of these like PRD elements that I'm talking about, that were, part of the directive body of the APO, tried to, kind of viewed the barricades as this more rebellious element that was out of their control. And so with the university barricade, that I was showing you before, this last barricade, they tried to like negotiate out the barricade with the federal government, because the federal government was really interested in all this like this show of ungovernability, this show of resistance in the streets, to be taken out so that streets could be open and have some type of like show of normalcy. And so when they tried to negotiate out the barricades with the federal government, the people of the barricades were like, hell no, basically. This barricade isn't negotiated. And it always comes back to this with the APO, that when anyone tries to get control, it's the people who are in the streets and the people themselves who are deciding what to do. And that's kind of like the setup in Oaxaca and with the popular assemblies, period, that it always comes back to what the people want, because the people are the base of the popular assembly. Okay, you want to keep on going? And so this happened again, with this question of like what the PRD is going to mean in Oaxaca, within the popular assembly. It's something that's really different from the Zapatistas, because the Zapatistas with the other campaigns says, you know what, like the PRD says they're leftist, we don't think they're leftist. Okay, pause it. What was I talking about? Okay. They've been criticized, the left of that, and the other campaign for not including the PRD in their formation. And so the APO is including the PRD, and there's been a lot of controversy over whether or not to include a political party, but in the end, it's the people in the bases of the APO that are going to decide. And so the indigenous bases in Oaxaca being a mostly indigenous state, they have a long history in Zapatismo, Maganismo, Autonomia. And it's really, really doubtful that the PRD is going to be able to exercise that much influence over these indigenous bases, for example. Within the structure of the APO, they can be a... Whoa, what is it? Oh, damn. I don't really do public speaking, you know what I'm saying? So, within the format of the APO, they, the PRD can be there, but how much power can they really exercise? Okay. So this is an Indymedia reporter who got beat up by 12 police because they saw the Indymedia. He's not an Indymedia reporter, he's an independent media reporter, but he has an Indymedia logo on his press badge. He got beat up by 12 police because they saw that Indymedia logo and they said, oh, you're independent media. Okay, we're gonna, beat the shit out of you, basically. Okay, can you go on? Also, this is the PRI was forcing their government workers to march in support of the PRI. I only have 5 minutes, so I'm gonna figure out how to do this. So the women of the APO, this is something that isn't really talked about when anyone talks about Mexico, is what's happening with the women and how the women are moving through all these different radical struggles. You hear about it with the Zapatistas, with the APO we haven't really heard about it that much. But really it's been the women who have been the most rebellious and the combative voices, for sure. Within the APO ranks. These are women carrying through a march for the dead and the disappeared in Oaxaca, 10,000 strong, a really powerful march. And they were later sprayed by water cannons by the police when they threw flowers at the police shields. And so, it's the women who were doing the takeovers of Canal 9, the TV station, who took over the TV station and were broadcasting and got the biggest viewer rates in the history of the TV station. And were broadcasting like this really intelligent and contextual analysis of Oaxaca in the context, of what was going on in the rest of Mexico. And it was women who were taking over radio stations. And it's the women when a lot of, when the men are on the front lines, maybe not even like really doing anything, and the women are on the front lines too, but it's the women you see behind, like filling up the shopping carts with rocks. And it's women who are doing the really hardcore political work around the political prisoners, and doing a lot of the dirt work. Yeah, the men are there too. But, the women have really a strong voice in the APO. What happened during the Congress was that, these type of questions that have, been brought up across Mexico about, what are the conditions, what are the characteristics of our movement going to look like? You know, how much representation are certain factions going to have? How are we going to organize horizontally and in a popular manner? And this is, like I said, all done on the fly. It's not done out of, some book on how to, make the revolution carry through, right? And so there was a point in the Congress where people had to decide, what the percentage of participation for the women was going to be in the APO-directed body, which is 222 people. So they had to decide between 50% and 33% minimum participation by women. And the thing is that in the Congress, these were all representatives from the different APO bases and from the different 350 integrated organizations within the APO. And they were mostly men who had gone there, who were chosen by their organizations or whatever to go there. And so, can you pause on this? And so, when it came time to decide, they chose 33% minimum representation for the women. And why was this? Because when they were debating about APO within the national context, they were talking about class. They were, breaking down all these different, factors on the national landscape of Mexico. And they never talked about patriarchy. They never actually integrated a gender analysis into their discussion about the participation of women. And so this was the major problem in how women got shafted during the Congress. This is, one of my criticisms of something that was really bad that happened in this kind of experimental process that was going down in the Congress. And like I said before, where a lot of the APO tactics are showing the government what they are at the same time as resisting, these women, all these stories started to come out because this 48-year-old woman called into the university radio one night and told this terrible story about how she was going through the Zocalo and basically got violently sexually assaulted by the federal police there. And so these women started to organize. All these other stories of sexual assault on the part of the government started to come out. And they started to organize, and they did this march, to the Zocalo. And this is what I'm saying about flipping the script on the authorities and saying, oh, you're trying to, take our identities as women and as strong, resistance fighters and stuff like this. You're trying to take our identity and to take our dignity away by degrading us down into sex objects, by threatening us with sexual assault. But we're going to take it right back to you and go to you with mirrors that say we are rapists written on them and show you who you really are. And this is something you see all the time in Oaxaca, flipping the script on the government and showing them who they really are. You want to go on? I'm going to go over time. Sorry, because the photos just have like this certain unless you guys really want me to shut up. But anyway, okay. So how are popular assemblies formed, more or less? The popular assemblies came out basically just by combining forces. It's actually not rocket science. Everybody who is working on the left, Oaxaca has this really, a really strong history of resistance and a lot of networks. And so everybody that was working in these networks kind of came together and formed this popular assembly based on these things that I'm talking about, and that Kinect is probably going to talk about, is these questions that are coming up in Mexico about, who do we want to work with, what are our alliances going to be, and what kind of characteristics our struggle is going to have. And that's what they were questioning, like I said, participation in unions, political parties, etc. And this is just kind of showing how popular the movement really is, how it goes across all types of class backgrounds, etc. This is someone writing on, on a hotel because the tourist industry is something that greatly marginalizes the people in Oaxaca. The repression is something that's really, really important to remember, and especially when you're thinking about the fact that people are still continuing to resist. On the 25th and the 20th, there was mega marches including hundreds of thousands of people. There was just one on the 10th. Even though the last week of November was the most violent week in the history of the 6-7 month struggle in Oaxaca. People, 350,000 people still came out on the 10th of December just now. So they're, like I said, they're going without pause. There's nothing that is going to stop them right now. And so these mega marches were, you know, it's not like what people think, where it's just like, you know, oh, it's just like the liberals, they're walking around like sheep, you know, in circles, and what do these marches really do? But really, like, these marches come in and they collect people from all these different towns on the way in to Oaxaca. They start from the outside, and it shows, like, how much, like, popular support there really is. And, you know, both of these marches were, when they got to the center of the city, and there was, you know, kind of like this confrontation with the police on terms of, we don't want you here, what are you doing here, you're not welcome. And these type of tactics where they're just saying, you know, you're not welcome, and not really, you know, confronting the police on a physical level, but the police have started confrontations. And right now, the death count is really hard to say. I know on the 25th, there was 3 confirmed dead. We heard for, you know, where we were hiding out on the 25th, that night when everybody went into hiding, we heard the gunshots very close that were, you know, about 10 minutes long when paramilitary sprayed into a group of people who were hiding out outside of the university, the Faculty of Medicine, not in the university, but actually in the center of the city. That killed 3 people. Actually, like, the Federal Preventive Police said to a hotel worker that night, on the night of the 25th, these are actually photos from the 20th, but in a while there's going to be those from the 25th. Some police officers said to a hotel worker who had given them water that night when they were roaming around, arbitrarily beating and detaining people, and ultimately they've been torturing them inside the prisons. They said, you know what, like, we've killed 13 people, but nobody's ever gonna know about it because we've hidden the bodies and the press isn't gonna find out. This is a situation in Oaxaca. There's about, I think, 35 people who are disappeared right now. The number is kind of hard to keep track of because it's unknown. These are people building a barricade to keep the police from moving outside of the center and taking over more of the city. But, you know, these disappearances off the street all goes back to the dirty war of the 70s and 80s. You know, this is something, you know, on the tactical side of the government. They've been trying to divide and conquer Oaxaca for a really long time, using like state interference in rebellious communities by paying off like local officials and stuff like this to have political loyalty to the governor. And it just doesn't work in Oaxaca because there's so much cohesion between people. And so now they've resorted to dirty war tactics, especially before the first, because Calderon was like, get rid of this movement before I come in. So in Oaxaca, they're dealing with like a really grave situation in terms of human rights. There's 200 out of the 250 prisoners that were captured, and you know the number is always rising. In the last week of November, after the 25th, everybody pretty much went into hiding. There was hundreds of people who had federal warrants, stuff like this. People getting disappeared off the streets, people being shot. And so, out of the 250 people who got captured, there's 241 people who have been transferred miles and miles and miles and miles, state, into another state in the north of the country, 141 people who are out of communication and believed to be under really bad torture. So that's the situation, like, on the level of solidarity that people really need to be thinking about, is those prisoners and exposing the type of repression that's being used. These are shots from the 25th, and like I said, this is about an hour before the confrontation went on. It was a battle that lasted about 7 hours in all. It was really amazing, the resistance that people put up, and just absolutely everybody, children, old men, you know, everybody came out and was resisting the federal forces there during that battle. The week afterwards, you know, when everybody went into hiding in the houses and the police were carrying out all these house searches, just going in, arresting people, beating everybody, chasing people down the streets. Nobody could leave. People would leave and go to the market. They wouldn't come back. And it was really stressful. And people had to sneak out of the city. And this is like the type of conditions that people are living under in Oaxaca. And people are still resisting. Like, that's the crazy thing that people have to remember. is that, you know, it doesn't stop there for people in Oaxaca. And right now, you know, like what they're doing is they're really reorganizing and strategizing and gathering their forces and seeing what the best tactical way to do that is. And so another thing, you know, there's so many things I could go on about Oaxaca and about like a lot of subtleties and stuff like this. You know, another thing is that there were, I just kind of like lost track of my thoughts by looking at the photos. I have to like kind of like try to ignore them. In terms of international solidarity, there's, you know, been a lot of solidarity going into the same organizations, which is something you really have to look out for, the organizations that are most visible to foreigners. But there has been like a lot of solidarity. I think that also, you know, there's been some problems on the ground with some of the solidarity. I think also that, especially after what happened the last week of November and what people are living through now with the police carrying out all sorts of making good on a lot of federal warrants and torturing people in prison, is people like really need to re-strategize the type of solidarity that came out after the death of Brad Will, and you know, talk about what that looks like and why, you know, if there's like some type of a medium or a long-term strategy for solidarity with Mexico. And why, you know, after the death of Brad Will, that there was all this type of attention, you know, gathered onto Oaxaca, which is actually like a historical thing. It happened in the late 70s in Nicaragua too, that, you know, a white journalist got killed, and then all of a sudden people noticed that there was an uprising and these massacres in Nicaragua. It's the same situation in Oaxaca. And, you know, really think about how can we continue to effectively, you know, draw attention onto what's going on in other places while organizing locally and while not doing it, you know, on a, you know, subtly racist basis. Of it always has to be something that, you know, really, it, you know, if a white person dies, that's when we can really draw attention to something. And whether the strategy to use the mass media to draw attention to Oaxaca because everybody was concentrating on the death of Brad Will is a strategy that perpetuates this type of thing where, you know, the death of a white person has more value than the death of you know, a Mexican person, for instance, or not. So that's just what I want to say about that, is it's you know, solidarity has to continue and on a, you know, a local organizing level, and it has to continue especially after, especially with what's going on now. So that is like, was really hard to do, and I'm sorry for the time.